Your healthy radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
I'll be bringing in a brand new year.
Hello, America. It's Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. Glad you're on board with me. It's 2016 Tuesday. We are getting ready to ring out the old year and ring in the new. And I am so glad you're joining me for this pre-New Year's Eve celebration. I'm here in my black party frock and pearls, all set to celebrate with you. And I've got some lineup. I've put together a very special gift, a special gift from me to you to say Happy New Year's. We've got a report from on the ground in Iowa about the upcoming caucus. Another report from a political expert on the ground in New Hampshire giving us a survey of how the more moderate Republican candidates are doing up there. And just in case no Republican candidate makes it to the convention with a sufficient number of delegates to claim victory, we've also got an expert coming in later in the show to talk about what would happen at that convention if, in fact, no one is the clear winner on the first vote, and also the possibility of a third-party candidate run. You can reach us at Ingraham Angle or BetsyMcCoy.com and call us at 855-40-LAURA. That's 855-40-LAURA. We're eager to hear from you. And in the meantime, let's start out with today's headlines. Here's this first headline, where PC definitely trumps safety. And I'm using Trump there as a verb, not the candidate himself. But here's a case in New York City where a woman who has failed the physical exam to join the fire department six times in a row is being given a seventh chance. And this time the fix is in because the fire department does not want to have a gender discrimination suit. Wendy Tapia has failed to run the obstacle course in the sufficient time six separate times. She couldn't do it. She's never had a day on the force, but now she's being given another chance to join New York's bravest. So I guess we have to say, if you're in New York and your apartment or your hotel room catches on fire, call the ACLU. Is that the answer? Or maybe call 911, but tell them you don't want Wendy Tapia climbing that ladder to rescue you. Here's a second headline, and this one really is one of the outrages of the year. Taxpayers, that's you and I, will be shelling out millions and millions of dollars now, our hard-earned money, to reimburse the Iranian hostages who sat in that terrible prison under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Remember all those months that went by? And they were trapped there. The gall here is not that we're reimbursing these hostages, or in some cases their descendants, but that we're paying for this rather than Iran. That was part of the Iranian deal signed several months ago. Signed, by the way, only by the president, not by Iran. And what's really outrageous is that all this spending was slipped into the omnibus spending bill agreed to by Congress just a few days ago, a $1.1 trillion omnibus spending bill. Remember when Congress promised to rein in spending and spare our children and grandchildren from the burden of an unsustainable debt? Well, they chucked that promise very quickly. The new budget is $1.1 trillion, and it includes our money going to reimburse the Iranian hostages, or in some cases their families, because Iran refused to do so. Boy, what a deal that was. We got clobbered on both ends. Here's something that brings a tear to anybody's eye. Tomorrow, a former NYPD detective, Joseph Lem, who when he left the force joined the Air Force and went to Afghanistan will be laid to rest at St. Patrick's Cathedral. He was one of six airmen killed in Afghanistan last week. And we want to say to his family our heartfelt gratitude. Moments of silence don't work well on the radio, but certainly a moment of gratitude, a moment of sympathy for his family, a moment of thanks to all who give their lives for our country. Here's a whopper. A new poll says the terrorists are winning their battle against the U.S. I can't believe they had to take a poll to figure that out. Only 38% of Americans approve of the way President Obama is handling terrorism. I wonder where they found those 38%. The poll was conducted December 17th through the 21st. I have five Trump headlines. Number one, the left-leaning Boston Globe. Even the left-leaning Boston Globe has decided to call Donald Trump the biggest winner of the year. With the Iowa caucuses a little more than a month away, Trump is the odds-on favorite to win the Republican nomination. The editors at the Boston Globe never thought it was possible. Here's another one for Donald Trump. He has ratcheted up his attacks on Hillary Clinton, blasting her for playing the woman card, and saying if she keeps doing that, her husband is going to be fair game. Remember his shenanigans. Get ready for a Donald Trump media blitz. Sources say Donald Trump will launch a major ad blitz that could cost $2 million a week, all out of his own bank account. That'll certainly boost the economy. The initial wave of ads will focus on Trump's vision and his stance on the key issues, including, of course, the southern border and Muslims. On the preposterous side, in the fashion world this year, huge derrières are the new fashion statement, thanks to Kim Kardashian and Jennifer Lopez. But implant procedures rose 98%. I guess rose is the right verb, rose 98% in 2014. Boy, amazing. 2,438 women have gotten butt enhancement procedures. It is now the third most popular plastic surgery. In the have they no shame category, this is really have no shame. Teresa Guidici, one of the New Jersey housewives who was released from prison this week, having served her time for fraud, tax evasion, and other crimes, arrived in New Jersey, where else, to see in the driveway a brand new Lexus SUV with a big red bow on it from her husband. That's pretty amazing. I'm looking at the story, and it really is have they no shame. They've got reality TV there at their New Jersey mansion, filming all of it and saying, don't worry about the price of the car. We've already sold the rights to a whole story about what it was like to be in federal prison. It's called Turning the Tables from Housewife to Inmate and Back Again. Of course, there's going to be more jailhouse drama when her husband, Juicy Joe, begins serving his time in March. And this was my favorite headline. The bureaucrats get the best of Obama. Of course, President Obama has been promising since before 2008 to close Guantanamo. But the Pentagon bureaucrats have gotten the best of him because the countries that volunteer to take some of these detainees insist on having their medical records, and the Pentagon officials just refuse to send them. That's why many of those Guantanamo prisoners are still sitting there twiddling their thumbs, because the Pentagon bureaucrats have refused to send medical records, photographs, and other basic documentation that foreign governments insist on before taking the detainees. So those are the headlines. After the break, I have a fascinating guest for you, Heather McDonald, who is going to be talking about policing and whether the cops have decided to throw in the towel, and that's why crime is rising all over the country. We'll be back after the break. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show. Happy New Year.
glad you stayed with me, Bubala. Happy New Year. It's coming up. I'm Betsy McCoy, standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, or you can email me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And on the line with me is a very special guest, Heather McDonald, a senior fellow, John M. Olin Fellow, at the Manhattan Institute, one of the smartest women in America. And she's going to be chatting with us about the Ferguson effect. What is that, Heather?
Well, thanks for having me on, Betsy. It's great to talk to you. The Ferguson effect is the phenomenon of officers backing off of proactive policing under the onslaught of vitriol and hatred and lies that have been thrown against them at the last year under the auspices of the Black Lives Matter movement. Officers backing off, not making proactive stops or enforcing low-level criminal laws like broken windows policing. And crime is going up. Violent crime, homicides, and shootings are spiking up in cities across the country.
Up 11%, right? 11%. That's a huge increase in homicides.
Well, actually, the Brennan Center that produced that number revised it recently upwards. It's now 14.6%. The blog 538 is estimated 16% at the nation's 60 top cities. So this is a major reversal of the crime drop of the last 20 years that happened because officers started using data to go after crime and started using their constitutional powers to intervene in suspicious behavior before it ripens into a felony. Now what's going on in inner cities is really the breakdown of law and order. When officers go to make an investigation or make a lawful arrest, they're routinely surrounded by people cursing at them, jeering, trying to block their movements. The cell phones are up. People are sticking the cell phones in people's faces. And there's been a complete delegitimation of lawful police authority that has begun really at the top of our nation. President Obama constantly makes the false charge that policing is racially biased, and that's just not the case, Betsy.
Well, I know you've done decades of research on this, from stops on the New Jersey State Turnpike to other kinds of research to show that, in fact, racial bias is not prevalent in policing.
The police go where crime is, and for the last 20 years, we've been having this obsessive conversation about alleged police racism in order not to talk about a much more troubling and difficult problem, which is black-on-black crime. The black crime rates are so astronomically higher than those of whites and Asians that the police cannot help but have more heavy presence, be engaged in more frequent pedestrian stops in inner-city neighborhoods than they are in white-majority neighborhoods. For instance, the black homicide rate is 8 times higher than that of whites and Hispanics combined. If you take out Hispanics, it's about 11 times higher than the homicide rate of whites. And the black death-by-homicide rate is understandably also a lot higher. That's the racial inequities that we should be worried about. Blacks die of homicide at 6 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. Those types of crime disparities mean that when the police are trying to protect victims, they are going to be disproportionately deployed in minority neighborhoods.
And when they don't go into those neighborhoods, or when they stop arresting suspects, it's poor people, largely African Americans, who suffer the most.
Absolutely. And these are the voices that the media, that the New York Times, the Washington Post, National Public Radio, refuse to listen to. I routinely go to police community meetings in inner city neighborhoods, whether South Central Los Angeles or Harlem in New York City or Central Brooklyn. And what I hear from those good bourgeois people that attend those meetings is we want more cops. There's dealers on the street. You arrest them, they're back the next day. There's kids hanging out on my stoop smoking weed. Why can't you arrest them for loitering or truancy? I want the kids in my lobby who are hanging out trespassing out of there because I'm terrified to pick up my mail. These are the people that ask, are begging for public order, for the type of safety and security that people in other neighborhoods take for granted.
Now, you spend a lot of time in New York City, and it appears that the mayor there, Mayor Bill de Blasio, has also made a point of vilifying cops.
Well, he did, and it was really extraordinarily shameful after the jury decided in Staten Island decided not to indict Officer Daniel Pantaleo for the arrest that led to the choking death of Eric Garner. De Blasio said that this represented centuries of racism, that he was fearful that his son Dante, who is biracial, would be killed by the cops. This is insane. The chances that the New York Police Department, which is 35,000, kill about 8 or 9 people a year. That is minuscule. The de Blasio's son has a much, much higher chance of getting shot by another black guy than he does by a cop. And the cops responded to this with utter horror, especially after two New York police officers were assassinated in cold blood in December of 2014. And they went on an informal strike as sort of an early Ferguson effect, backing off of proactive policing and crime here in New York, shooting shot through the roof.
As we close, Heather, you have so much valuable information. Give the presidential candidates some advice on how to provide more moral leadership here, because they could already be putting something of a stop to this problem.
Excellent point, Betsy. They've got to say that the cops are not racist. They have given the United States the biggest crime drop in recorded history, and they deserve our support.
And you do, too. Thank you very much, Heather. That's so interesting. When we come back, we're going to be addressing another big national problem with one of the best experts in the country. We're going to be talking with Larry Kudlow, Supply-Sider, the go-to expert on economic growth. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. It's Betsy McCoy back with you to celebrate the coming of New Year's Eve. It's 2016 Tuesday, and our next guest, Larry Kudlow, is one of my favorite human beings. He's a supply-sider, in fact, the go-to expert on economic growth. He's a Reaganite. He's a noted TV commentator. He has a nationally syndicated radio show called The Larry Kudlow Show, and he is widely talked about, maybe we can get him to talk about it himself, he is widely talked about as the next Republican senator from the state of Connecticut. So, Larry, thank you for joining us in our pre-New Year's Eve celebration.
Betsy, for you, happy, holy, and merry. That's for you.
Thank you.
That's for you.
Okay, so many people listening are in the same boat I'm in. They have grown-up kids who are looking for jobs. You're the economic expert. What should the next president do to make it easier for this millennial generation to succeed and get good jobs?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a key question for this election. And I'll give you my biggest take on this, is what we need to do in this country is absolutely slash the corporate tax rate. which is now 40%. We should bring it down to 15%, and it should apply, Betsy, not just to big companies, but the smaller S-corps, the LLCs, the small businesses. They should all pay the same low rate, and then you could add to that, make it real easy to repatriate foreign cash and give businesses full cash expensing as a deduction, because our corporate tax rate is the single biggest barrier to growth. There is no business investment, Betsy, for almost 20 years. And, yeah, you got a lot of money overseas. Some of it's because they do business there. Some of it's because the taxes are lower. I want that $2 trillion to come home and build factories and create jobs. And I want everybody to pay lower tax rates. So make America a magnet for foreign cash. And by the by, last quick point, all the studies show that a lower business tax rate benefits middle class wage earners the most. Okay? If you want to deal with middle class wages, and we need that, they are the biggest beneficiary, because remember, businesses don't pay taxes, they just pass it along. Lower wages, lower pensions, lower health costs, higher consumer prices, and better shareholder returns.
So you're saying if the taxes are lowered, they'll pay their workers more and they'll also price their goods in a lower way?
Yes, yes. See, we were the leader for many, many years. You know, John F. Kennedy cut corporate taxes. Then 20 years later, Reagan cut corporate taxes. We were the leader. All the capital came to the USA. But we've been asleep for 20 years. So Europe has knocked their corporate tax down to about 25. China is about 25. Canada is about 15. I want us to be at 15. And then make it easy to bring the foreign profits home, stop double taxing.
So that will also prevent companies from moving overseas. You know, you and I both spend a lot of time in Connecticut, and we see that all the big companies are leaving Connecticut. It's like the new Dodge City, the place everybody wants to get out of.
Listen, Connecticut, which is just a tragedy, not only do they have to pay the high federal corporate tax, Betsy, Connecticut has a 9% plus state corporate tax. On top of that, they pay capital gains. I believe Connecticut ranks something like 45th out of 50 states in the worst corporate tax. So, yes, Connecticut magnifies it. And you're quite right. Either A, you got all these companies moving down to Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina, or B, like General Electric. They've been there forever. Or Otis Elevator. They're all threatening to leave. Insurance companies have left. Financial service companies have left. Why? Because they don't want to pay uncompetitive taxes. Real simple. And, of course, if they go, the jobs go.
The jobs go, the tax revenue goes. Now, here's the other side of this. We just watched Congress, and this is my editorializing, totally betray conservatives by passing a $1.1 trillion spending bill. They passed it, of course, without reading it. And it's crammed full of things that are going to increase our debt. Another $830 billion added to the debt. So if you're going to lower the taxes, what are you going to do about these spendaholics in Washington?
Well, you know, you should clamp down. I mean, I told Paul Ryan, I said, look, among the many sins in this bill is you just broke the spending caps that were put into place a few years ago, and you keep breaking them every year. So you're going in the wrong direction. Now, the other thing I want Ryan to do is have a corporate tax reform bill next year, you know, next week. Pass the House, pass the Senate, put it on Obama's desk. If he wants to veto it, Betsy, fine.
But you know what these Republicans always say? They always say, oh, the president, he'll blame us for shutting down the government. They're actually trying to tell the American people that they can't govern until they control the White House and both houses of Congress.
Well, yeah, I remember they said they couldn't control it with the House, they needed the Senate.
Right.
And nothing happened.
Don't you feel
now
bamboozled?
I do, actually. And now they say, we got the House and Senate, but we need the White House. Look, first of all, okay, fine. Let's get the White House. But I like to see a little pressure.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd like to see right away, just come out and say it. You want to grow this economy at 4. You want to create good middle-class jobs with wages. Get the business tax down. Now, there's other stuff. You know, you and I would prefer a flatter individual tax. You and I want to reform Obamacare and get rid of those taxes. You're the expert. But I'm saying, if I could start in one place to give us big growth, that's where I'd start. Business taxes.
Now,
business taxes.
You know, Larry Kudlow knows all the candidates. They actually come and get advice from him. They sit at his knee. So you've met them all. You've talked to all of them. They all know you well. Which candidate do you think on the Republican side, because obviously Hillary Clinton won't do it, which candidate for president on the Republican side will actually put these reforms in place? Who's got the best package?
Well, you're going to laugh at this. But right now, the best I've seen is Trump.
Ha ha! I'm not laughing, honey.
He's got the 15% corporate tax that I wanted. In fact, he mentioned my name in the debate. And I think he's got an excellent plan. Now, in fairness, Cruz and Rubio and Christie are all moving in the right direction. I give them credit. But they're not as good, particularly on the business stuff, as Trump. They're just not. And I hope he stays with it because I think it's his best thing.
Why should we be surprised that this highly successful businessman understands taxes?
Well, that is a very important thing because I'm not surprised. I mean, I've talked to him down through the years. He gets it. Look, here's the funniest thing. You know this flap, Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes interviewed Tim Cook, the head of Apple. And Charlie accused Cook of dodging taxes by putting a lot of earnings overseas. And you know what Cook said? That is a lot of political crap. He just came out and said
right,
that.
He's obeying the law, right?
Right. He's obeying the law. First of all, he pays a fortune in taxes in the U.S. But why shouldn't he have overseas money? He owes it to his shareholders. And he owes it to his workers. So, you know what? These ideas may have a chance. I'm kind of optimistic about this. And it's a good New Year's thing. But the leadership, Betsy, you know, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan. I love Ryan. He's a pro-growth guy. They have just got to be tough. Tough. Pass it. Put it on Obama's desk. Let Obama veto it. Fine. Then let's go to 2016 and have it out.
Speaking of tough, now I know you're an expert economist, but you have also weighed in a very constructive way on the issue of Iran. In fact, that's what really made you a possible candidate for the United States Senate, because unfortunately the senator currently representing Connecticut, Richard Blumenthal, is, well, the most you can say about him is that he was a shameless waffler on that issue.
Nah, he voted for it. He votes with Obama. He's soft on this.
He's very soft on this.
So refugees.
Now that
he doesn't understand ISIS, he doesn't understand anything. This is a big issue, Betsy. You're right.
It's a very big issue. And I've got to get your take on this. There are 36 Republican senators who are demanding now that we maintain the sanctions on Iran because they're holding a Washington Post reporter, because they're launching ballistic missile tests, because they don't appear to be in any way sincere, it's a funny word to use, about complying even with this phony deal. So where
I'm
would you...
I'm with him. Look, why should we give Iran $150 billion in order to kill more Americans, in order to sponsor more terrorism? Why should we give more visas or visa waivers when we know damn well ISIS is gaming the system? and we'll use that to come over here and bomb our cities. Why should we allow more refugees here or more new immigrants here when we know ISIS wants to game the system? You know, let's help the refugees put a couple billion dollars into a safe place in Syria. I'm fine with that. Come here? No. This is wartime. We got to protect America. That's my take on that. It's a big issue, a very big issue.
We are at war, even though a war hasn't been declared. If you were in the Senate, wouldn't you push hard for a declaration of war?
Immediately. Immediately. And they should have done it in this go-around, Betsy. I want to see a U.S. lead a NATO war resolution, a U.N. Security Council war resolution, a domestic congressional war resolution, and let's have an emergency conference with our so-called Arab allies and start figuring out how they can contribute more. Absolutely, it's a gigantic issue. You saw the paper today. Terrorism has now taken over as the number one concern of Americans, even beating the economy.
And the polls all showed that even Democrats do not believe that this president is waging an effective campaign against ISIS.
That's right. If I make this run, Betsy, I'm going to do two things. Number one, I'm going to unleash you around the state to speak. That's going to be number one. And number two, I'm going after Democrats and independents. But I'm taking you up there with me. I want you to make the pitch.
I'll be at your side. The fact is you would make a great senator, great on economics, great on foreign policy, and most importantly, committed to American values. We can go over a bit, and I want to take a call on line three for Larry Kudlow from Randy in Ocala, Florida. Randy, if you can ask your question quickly.
Quickly, if taking the corporate tax rate from 40 to 15 is good, why not flip-flop the economy, stop taxing labor and capital completely, and take us to a consumption-based tax system that zeroes out all corporate taxes?
Larry?
I'm all for it. I'm all for it, Randy. I'm all for it. I've long believed in abolishing the corporate tax. I'm just a little bit incremental here. In other words, give me a first stop at 15, and then we'll take it to zero. Get rid of the loopholes, right? Get rid of the special corporate loopholes. And that's the optimal position. You are absolutely correct on that. It's just that I'll take what I can get in the first go-around. But
Randy,
I agree with your theoretical position.
Thank you for a great question, Randy. And Larry, thank you for a great interview. Happy New Year, and let's hope you are the next senator from the state of Connecticut. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
It's going to be a funky new year. It's going to be a great new year. Welcome back, Bubba. Glad you stayed with me. This is Betsy McCoy in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. That's 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. That's an email. And with us now is a real star from Iowa politics, someone you need to listen to. His name is Sam Clovis. He's a retired colonel in the United States Air Force, a graduate of the Air Force Academy. And he's going to give us in a few minutes a report from the ground in Iowa about what Donald Trump is doing and what the other candidates are doing as well. Sam, in full disclosure, is a senior policy advisor to the Trump campaign. And before that, he was associated with Rick Perry's campaign. He has seen the politics up close. And he can give us a real assessment on who's going to win this Iowa caucus. One of the interesting things about this caucus is it's not like a primary where people just go to their polling place and vote. This is a completely different ball game. And the reason is that each of the candidates has to actually organize people and transport them to a caucus event. It means renting halls, renting buses, staging house parties, it's like herding cats. It puts a premium on organizational skills on a ground team in the state. And it'll be interesting to see how Obama, not a career politician, is managing this job. But in the meantime, we've got Trump in the headlines in two rather intriguing ways. First of all, Time magazine has now found that Donald Trump and Pope Francis are tied for second place
Healthy radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Welcome back, America. Thanks for joining me for this pre-New Year's Eve celebration. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. And this is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And joining me now is one of my favorite people, Sam Clovis. He's a political expert, a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy, a former colonel in the United States Air Force, but of late a real expert on Iowa politics. And he is Donald Trump's senior policy advisor, one of the most important people in Donald Trump's campaign. And I've got him on the line to give us an up-close explanation of the Iowa caucus and what's happening there. Sam, thank you for joining me.
Well, it's great to be on with you. It's great. Happy New Year, Betsy. It's great to talk to you. And a lot of people don't know that we're real pals and we go back a ways. So it's great to be on with you, and I always look forward to this.
Well, thank you. Sam is usually on the other side of the microphone because he has had a very, very popular radio program, talk radio program in Iowa. But right now he's doing something very big as Donald Trump's senior policy advisor. And I see here, Sam, that Trump is now in a dead heat with Clinton in a couple of polls, and he has just tied with Pope Francis as the second most admired man. President Obama, the presidents usually take first place, but tied for second place with Pope Francis is the Donald. So tell us what you think of that.
Well, it's been going on. I think it's a lot of it has to do with the fact that Mr. Trump has been speaking truth to power to the people. I think that this is something a lot of the pundits, I noticed even this morning, Betsy, when I was getting ready to come up to talk to you, that there are a lot of the pundits now that have been extremely critical of the campaign and critical of Mr. Trump are starting to see that light that indicates that he, in fact, could very well be the nominee of the Republican Party. And even more important, that he could very well win the presidency of the United States. And a lot of this has to do with the message that he has, the fact that he's been, it's very simple, it's very straightforward. It speaks directly to the people of the United States, which is something that has been missing for so long in this country. And I think that this is really a once-in-a-lifetime phenomena. I've been watching politics, as you know. I'm 66 years old. I don't mind telling people that. I've been watching politics since I was 7. The first thing I remember is the 1956 Republican convention. And I've been a political junkie ever since. And I've never seen anything in my lifetime that equates to what we're seeing with this revival of a populist America, Americans first approach to politics. And I think it's high time. It's the right man at the right place at the right time.
Well, so many smart people are reaching that conclusion, you among them. But also, I was just interviewing the famous supply side economist, Larry Kudlow. And I asked him, you've talked to all the candidates. They all come sit at your knee and ask for economic advice. Which candidate has the best economic plan? He said Donald Trump.
By far. And the thing is, it's practical, it's pragmatic, it's realistic. It deals with we're not talking tectonic plate shifting here. We're talking about common sense approach to tax reform, simplification, flattening the tax. And our biggest move, I think, is in corporate taxes and what we do with corporations and how we end up treating people who have small businesses now will be treated with the and will have the same effect of corporate taxes if our reforms go through. And this will free up anywhere from $2.5 to $4 trillion in capital to come back to the United States. It will spur growth like we've never seen. We think that our models indicate to us that we can see Reagan era, if not better, growth for a 10-year period at least. This will allow us to balance the budget without increasing our spending. And we think budget discipline, tax reform, and trade reform are three really important features of what we're talking about economically.
I hope all the people who are in my situation with adult children looking for jobs are listening, because lowering that corporate tax rate and applying that much lower rate to small businesses as well as to the big corporations will produce a huge surge in new jobs. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. And because a lot of times right now what we have, and this has been the theme that we've been talking about since Mr. Trump started the campaign, is the notion that the government of the United States, any government, should be in the business of removing uncertainty from people's lives instead of increasing uncertainty. And I think that right now today there's very little confidence in the federal government, a little bit more in state government and local government, but very little confidence in government across the board. And I think what that problem is, that governments have gotten too big to succeed. It's not the fact that they're too big to fail. They've become too big to succeed. They're not agile. They don't have the ability to adjust to issues. Another perspective that I think is important here, Betsy, is that what we see, and this is one of the things that I think from a personal perspective as an analyst, or if I remove myself from my role as a policy advisor in a campaign or the national co-chair of a campaign, if I remove myself from that position and put on my academic hat, I see very much the thing that a lot of other people are seeing, and that's that we see people who are out here playing whack-a-mole. They're going out here and addressing these issues on a micro-tactical level as opposed to seeing the big picture. We don't have the organizing principles or the strategic vision in any of the candidates except Mr. Trump that allows us to see how all these pieces fit together and why these pieces are important to have them all work together so that we can have some certitude as we go forward and to increase the overall wealth of the nation. And if the United States is wealthy and healthy and doing well, the rest of the world will follow behind, because we need the United States in the leadership position.
And we do need a very strong economy in order to be a force in world affairs as well. Now that we're facing such an enormous threat from ISIS, for example, as well as threats from Putin and China. So tell us also a little bit more, get down into the specifics of Mr. Trump's foreign policy, because we hear a lot of bluster. It's the media's fault, really, not Mr. Trump's fault. But I'd like to hear, since you are the senior policy advisor, a little bit more about Mr. Trump's overall foreign policy.
Well, it's ironic you bring that up, because we're working on a major foreign policy piece right now as we speak. That's the thing that's in the middle of my desk. So this is an opportune time. I won't give you all of the particulars of it, but I will give you the general outline. What we're really facing here are two separate issues, and we have to have a strategic vision. And again, I go back to that point. We have to have some sense of organization. What are the principles? What are the national interests? And the focus here should be on what the national interests of America are.
They should Amen. Be not somebody else's interest.
Exactly. It should be to protect the citizens of the United States. It should be to protect the resources that fund and fuel our economy. And third is to protect our allies and our alliances. If you have those in the forefront, if you have those as the organizing principles of foreign policy, then what you end up doing is you can start to make the determination of what is in the interest of the United States and what is not. And we should not expend a single penny on anything or a single drop of blood on anything that is not in the interest of the United States. So once you have those organizing principles established, then you face a two-headed monster when it comes to foreign policy. One is dealing with state actors. These are the traditional, these are the pinstripe suits. These are the people that we're used to dealing with on a nation-state level. But then we have something that is very much more amorphous, much more difficult to deal with, and this is non-state actors.
Like ISIS.
Well, ISIS is one. But here's a fact, Betsy, that I think a lot of people don't realize. The United States State Department has identified 57 terrorist organizations in the world. 57. These are terrorist organizations that are very high on our watch list and do all these other things. 46 of those 57 are identified with radical Islam. 46. So that's like franchises. Those are franchises. ISIS is a single franchise of something that is far greater, far more difficult, and something that we have to face in its totality, not in the tactical level of dealing with ISIS in a particular area. We're dealing with Boko Haram. We're dealing with Hezbollah. We're dealing with Hamas. We're dealing with any number of the Houthis in Yemen. We're dealing with any number of franchises that are associated and loosely affiliated through this notion of radical Islam. Radical Islam is not a religion. It is not an offshoot of religion. It is a political ideology that has to be addressed as such. And once we get our heads around the notion of dealing with a political ideology as opposed to a war on religion, then I think we have a much better chance of dealing with these issues and looking at the totality of what we're facing around the world. These are the things that we're missing in all of the other candidates. None of the other candidates seem to be able to make this differentiation or to look at the world in these perspectives. And I think this is a critical perspective that Mr. Trump has certainly captured the intellectual high ground on this effort.
Well, and that's why I think Americans are responding to his commitment to keeping this radical ideology from penetrating our borders.
Well, again, it goes back to immigration. I mean, think about all the ramifications of a sound immigration policy. If we were just to enforce the law, the laws that we have on the books right now, think about how much different these things would be. What people don't realize is that illegal immigration right now today eats up about $120 billion a year in taxpayer money at the state and local level. This is why the federal government, particularly the Congress of the United States, is not so engaged on immigration policy, because it's essentially a net zero aspect for them. So they're looking at it this from a political perspective rather than an economic perspective.
We could literally send every college age kid in this country to an in-state university for what we're spending on these illegals.
Well, here's the other thing. Let's think about it. Let's take this.
Sam, I've got to wrap up soon, but let me extract a promise from you. You are so knowledgeable, and everyone is so interested in what a Mr. Trump presidency would look like, and we don't get enough of the specifics from the television programs. So I hope you'll join us again.
I'll come back anytime, Betsy, and it's great, and Happy New Year to you, and God bless you, and I wish you the very best.
Well, thank you. That's Sam Clovis, senior policy advisor to the Donald Trump campaign, speaking to us from Iowa. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. And after the break, Congressman Steve King, also from Iowa, and affiliated or endorsing the Ted Cruz campaign. So we've got all the stars today. Be back after the break.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Start the new year right.
Hello, America. We are starting the new year right. Welcome to our pre-New Year's Eve celebration. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can email me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And joining us now is the most principled conservative in the United States Congress, a true guardian of the United States Constitution, Congressman Steve King from Iowa. And all the presidential candidates come on bended knee asking for his endorsement, but he has recently given it to Ted Cruz. So, Congressman Steve King, how's it going for Ted Cruz in Iowa?
It's going really well, Betsy. Not only is my ear to the ground here, and I'm out and engaged with people, and I get a chance to speak, but especially to listen and listen to what people say, and I can feel it. It's moved into what is beginning to be a groundswell here for Cruz, and it is just as I'm watching, as you mentioned, principled conservatives and constitutional conservatives. It seems like they're all moving towards Cruz, and the polling has gone in that direction too. November 16th. That was on that day. I know that Cruz, the polling average of Cruz here in Iowa was around 9.7%, some down to 6, some up to 10. I think the average was 9.7. And a month later, there were polling that had him up to 40%. And now it's very consistently in that area. And the constitutional conservatives have moved from Carson, from Huckabee, from Santorum, and Rand Paul, mostly those, on towards Cruz, and of course out of the undecided. And Trump's been fairly stable, but he's running second in Iowa, and it may be the only state that he's clearly doing that.
Right. This caucus is February 1st, and a lot of it has to do with organization, right? It's not like the New Hampshire primary where people go to their polling places. Can you explain to everyone all around the country what it looks like that day, the buses, the house parties, et cetera?
Oh, it is something. I used to host the caucus for my precinct in my construction office, and it was the only place in town that had handicap accessible at the time. So in any case, I'm there as the host, and we elect a temporary chair. The temporary chair holds the election for a permanent chair for our precinct. And then from there, we start bringing the planks for the platform and electing delegates to our county convention. And then we also then, during that process, we entertain speeches from those who are advocating for any and all of the presidential candidates that are announced. And I believe it's open also for anyone to introduce a name that hasn't been announced. So you could actually be nominated for president in your own precinct and have someone give a speech for you. But if you would do that yourself, they would look at you like you were pushing your own vanity button.
Politicians are very good at that. Not you, but those presidential candidates, they all have big vanity buttons, don't you think? That's a good...
It takes an ego in this business, Betsy. It does. I've never been able to master that balance of humility and ego and still stay in the political arena. Of course, Frank's filled me in on this, another fine conservative. He said, funny thing about humility, about the time you believe you've reached it, you've lost it.
That's true. Now, on to an issue that's really resonating with people. On your website, you have a list of the horrible crimes committed by illegal immigrants all over the country. And tell us where Ted Cruz stands on that.
Oh, I have no doubt where he stands. It's this, that to understand it, and I posted on my website the crimes committed against generally American citizens, but not always people lawfully present in America for the most part, is that I began to ask the question, we know about how many people died in the desert trying to get into America. They keep us fairly well apprised of that. But I began to ask the question, how many Americans died at the hands of those who actually made it into America? At the hands of illegal aliens. And that's the subject on my website. And Ted Cruz is for this. He's for enforcing a law. He's for enforcing existing law. And in doing so, that cleans up the illegal population in America and essentially stops the committing of crimes against Americans by illegals because they won't be here to do it.
Thank you. Congressman King, go to his website. Congressman Steve King from Iowa, a real principled conservative with a long list of crimes committed by illegal immigrants in this country. Happy New Year. It's coming up. This is Betsy McCoy. Glad you stayed with me. I'm standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. And we'll be talking with John Fund in a moment. But first, we've got a call on line one from Betty. Betty, what's on your mind?
Well, hi there, Betsy. I do know that you're an expert on hospital infection deaths and Obamacare, but I wanted to know specifically what you think about the limiting of the PSA test for men under Obamacare.
Well, I'm very concerned. Let's get the facts straight. I'm very concerned, and I'm glad you called in about this. The prostate-specific antigen test is covered, but unfortunately, the Obama administration wants to penalize doctors who routinely order the PSA blood test under a new proposed Obama administration policy. Doctors will get demerits and be considered overspenders for routinely ordering that test. So doctors are going to be skipping the test in order to be rewarded with a higher quality rating from the government and, as a result, being paid more. But this is really dangerous for patients. And we already see coming out two new studies that indicate that we're going to be seeing more and more men with advanced prostate cancer being diagnosed at that late stage of the disease when it's no longer curable. And that's the concern.
Wow, that sounds like it's a very, very dangerous road.
So if a man in your life comes home from the doctor and says, oh, the doctor told me I don't need that PSA test every year, send him back to get it, because, in fact, you should be getting it. Thanks for calling, Betty.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, let me introduce our guest, John Fund. I'm so glad he's joining us. He's extremely smart. He is an expert on voter fraud and also third-party candidacies and election law in general. And, John, thanks for joining us today. He's currently the National Affairs columnist for National Review Online and a senior editor at the American Spectator.
Pleasure, Betsy. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, as everyone wants to know, number one, what is the chance that Donald Trump will become a third-party candidate? What's your view on this?
Very low. For one thing, he did take a pledge not to do that, and I think that would damage his credibility immediately. Pledges do mean something to the American voters. Ask the first President Bush, who broke his anti-tax pledge. Secondly, Donald Trump is cheap. Notice how little of his own money he's spent on the campaign so far. He doesn't to actually run a real presidential campaign would be a proposition of $100-$150 million. Donald Trump can afford that, but he doesn't want to spend it. And third, the chances of actually succeeding as a third-party candidate are very low. Michael Bloomberg spent millions of dollars investigating running as a third-party candidate and concluded it can't really be done in a system that's basically designed and rigged for two parties only.
Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at the state laws, it appeared that very unlikely that someone could get on the ballot in a sufficient number of states, because those state deadlines precede, in many cases, the National Republican Convention.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, I think that the candidate who would win the Republican nomination would it's likely that that candidate will be determined in April or May. And that would the first deadline is May 16th, which is Texas. So I think Donald Trump could still do it because he has money and could pay for signature gatherers. But the bottom line is he's not going to run, because if he lost, he'd be a loser. And of course, that's the one thing Trump never wants to be, a loser.
Right. Now, last spring, as I recall, you predicted that he'd be out of the race pretty quickly. Are you surprised?
No. I didn't say he'd be out of the race. I said he was not going to get the nomination, and I did underestimate his strength. That much I did. The anger in the country is even deeper and more profound than even I thought.
Do you think there's a chance now he will get the nomination?
No. For one thing, he's not doing the things that a candidate who really, really wants the nomination would do. He's not buying lists of voters, which are readily available at a very low cost from the Republican National Committee. He's not doing effective voter outreach in Iowa, at least not yet. And he's not doing the kind of hiring and the kind of groundwork in the states that don't vote early. you know, if you go beyond Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada and South Carolina, it's really hard to find a Donald Trump infrastructure. Now, admittedly, he is trying to reinvent the whole game. His strategy is, I get enough free media that I can dominate the airwaves. I've gotten twice as much media time as any other candidate, and I'm going to rewrite the rules of politics, and you don't need people to turn out the vote because I'm a different kind of candidate. Now, there's a chance that that's right, but it will be the first time in American history that will have been done.
He sure turns out people to attend his speeches, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, but so do others. Ted Cruz gets lots of people at his rallies. Hillary Clinton occasionally can get good crowds at rallies. Remember, he's a celebrity as well as a candidate. And Betsy, you know that that's very important. He was star of a reality TV show for 12 years. The curiosity factor is very important. Lots of people, I've been to Trump rallies. There are lots of people there who are curious about Trump and want to see him. But when you actually ask them, are you going to vote for him? They're not sure. And if you, and it's in Iowa, if you ask them, are you going to go out at 7 o'clock on a cold winter night and spend 3 hours at a caucus? Because that's how long it takes. Many of them say, no, I'm not that interested.
That's really interesting. Now, you just wrote a column, not about Donald Trump, but about somebody with almost no name recognition, Jim Webb, the former Virginia senator and Navy secretary. And you suggested he might be a spoiler running for president on an independent line. Tell us more about that.
Well, the race looks like it's going to be close between Hillary Clinton and whoever the eventual Republican candidate is. If it's close, that can mean somebody who gets even 1 or 2% of the national vote can have a major impact. Ralph Nader did just that in 2000. He took more votes than was the difference between Gore and Bush in several states. So Ralph Nader also didn't have very much money, but he had a message. And Jim Webb's message, if he can get it out, and of course with social media and the internet, you can get out a message much more cheaply than you could in the past. His message was, you're fed up with both parties, so am I. And Hillary Clinton didn't show inept leadership as Secretary of State. She gave us the Libyan disaster, which led to the Syrian disaster. And the Republicans, they're either extreme or they're inexperienced in foreign policy.
But Jim Webb doesn't expect to win. So is it true that if he runs as a third-party candidate, he will give the race to the Republicans?
Well, maybe. His military background would certainly appeal to many Republicans because it's likely that both candidates will not have had any military service. On the other hand, I think he's entering the race because he really doesn't think Hillary Clinton is qualified for or honest enough to be president. And he made that very clear the brief period of time he was running as a Democrat, although the media ignored him. And I think his messages, his criticism, would be more directed at Hillary Clinton. And there are a lot of independents and there are a lot of people in the military who are Democrats who Clinton would be a break from the Obama failed foreign policy.
What can we do to encourage Mr. Webb?
Oh, I don't think he needs encouragement. I just think the media should cover him because he's a serious person with a serious message. And he actually does have real ideas. For example, he believes that we need to have a much more flexible, much more nimble Pentagon. He's Secretary of the Navy. I think he has the experience to do that. He also does not believe in Hillary Clinton-style interventions in nation building, which is what Libya was. Remember, Hillary Clinton voted against Iraq. Then she said it was a mistake. And then she got us into Libya, and that was a mistake, too. So she clearly does not learn from history.
Worst Secretary of State in history. Now, let me ask you something else. It's not easy to run a third-party candidacy. You have to get on the ballot in the states. It takes money and organization. Does he have it?
Not yet, but I think he can. The best estimates are that it would take less than $3 million to get on all 50 state ballots. So let's say you only wanted to get on the top 46, because there are about four states that have very tough ballot requirements. That would probably take only about $2.4 million. I think he can raise and spend that amount of money. And then the question is, how much media attention will he get? He probably wouldn't be included in the debates. On the other hand, I think that there would be a lot of people who'd be asking, you know, Hillary Clinton, some Republican we don't know much about, isn't there someone else? So I think he has a decent chance of getting a decent amount of attention.
Why wouldn't Republicans seriously raise the money and do everything they can to help this man?
Oh, that would be a mistake. because any kind of official Republican support would look like they were trying to game the system. They were trying to rig the system to create an anti-Hillary Democratic challenge. I'm sure if individual Republicans in an individual capacity with no official ties wanted to help him out, I suspect he'd welcome that, and that would be fine. It's a free country. But to have an organized attempt to help a third-party candidate, a lot of people don't think that would be fair play.
Mm-hmm. Gee, I didn't know Hillary was so familiar with fair play. Speaking of fair play and unfair play.
Well, yes, but remember, what if you do anything that can be criticized, she will criticize you for it. She's shameless.
Let me ask you this. You are an expert on voter fraud. You've written the encyclopedia on that issue. And my question is, what are you looking for in the upcoming election?
Well, there are lawsuits all over the country trying to overturn voter ID laws. And Betsy, the fascinating thing is they're financed by George Soros. George Soros is not helping Hillary directly, but he is financing lawyers, very expensive lawyers, to challenge all of these laws. Mark Elias is the lawyer bringing these suits. Do you know what Mark Elias's day job is?
No.
He's general counsel for Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Wow. So they want people to be able to go to the polls.
Hillary Clinton's lawyer is trying to knock down laws that have been proven to be effective in safeguarding against voter fraud. Why would that be?
Very interesting. So, and where
and
do you
think? By the way, all of this is in my book, Who's Counting? My book, Who's Counting, which you can get on Amazon.
Right.
And
Who's
it tells
Counting?
The whole story of how the Obama administration has tried to subvert our elections.
It is a superb book. Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote. What's the end of that title?
At Risk.
At Risk, right. It's a really great book. I have it at home. John Fund and Hans von Spakovsky. Let me ask you something. Where in the country do you think this will be occurring? Our last question before I unfortunately have to wrap up with you.
Well, here's a clue. There are hundreds and hundreds of counties in America where there are more registered voters than there are people living there, according to the Census Bureau, over the age of 18. I call that a clue that there's a lot of deadwood on the voting rolls and people could show up and vote in somebody else's name. Remember a couple years ago, James O'Keefe showed up and was actually given a ballot in Eric Holder's name. He didn't cast it because that would have been a felony. But with no questions asked, he simply said, do you have an Eric Holder on your voting rolls? He didn't even say it was Eric Holder, and they handed him his ballot.
Wow. It's amazing. Well, we'll have to have you back to give us more clues on how to prevent this voter fraud. The book is superb. This is the national expert on voter fraud. John Fund, thank you so much for joining us. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. When we get back, an intriguing book by a very intriguing novelist, Paul Battista.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Rocking around. Christmas tree.
We're rocking around celebrating Christmas and New Year's Eve coming up. Thank you for joining us. It's Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, celebrating with a pre-New Year's lineup. And joining me on the line is Paul Battista. He's a very famous criminal defense lawyer. You've seen him on Court TV and CNN and other television shows. And I asked him to join us to tell us about his latest novel, The Borzoi Killings, because when you're looking for a holiday gift, a Christmas gift for somebody, and you want to give them a real page turner, a real gripper, well, The Borzoi Killings is one of those books. Thank you, Paul, for joining us.
Thank you, Betsy, and Happy New Year and Christmas.
Happy New Year. Tell us briefly about this book, but don't give away the ending.
If I told you the ending, then I'd have to, you know, kill you, as they say.
Right. And everyone listening.
The ending is a surprise. Right. Actually, the book is set out here in the Hamptons. It's set in East Hampton, New York, and to put it simply, and it's not an overly complex novel. It's meant to be an entertaining read as a legal thriller. It's about the murder of the 10th richest man in the United States, And the arrest of a caretaker handyman who is an illegal Mexican immigrant who, among other things, looks a lot like Antonio Banderas, who is almost immediately arrested for the murder. The most significant character in the book is a very rare type of lawyer. A woman who is one of the two or three leading criminal lawyers in the United States. You know, we think criminal lawyers, we think about Johnny Corcoran and Clarence Darrow, and they're all men. Well, Raquel Ramadi is an extraordinarily accomplished criminal lawyer. And on a free basis, a pro bono basis, she takes an interest in the case, and she represents the illegal Mexican immigrant in a trial that, because of the nature of the victim, this extraordinarily rich hedge fund manager, has really become the most notorious trial of certainly the year, if not our new century. And it's a legal thriller, and as the trial progresses, we learn a lot. A lot, some of it quite lurid, about what goes on behind the hedgerows of the estates in East Hampton and Southampton.
Well, you've given us enough to whet our appetites for this book. It's a glimpse behind how the rich and famous live behind those hedgerows, and it's not always savory. But thank you for joining us, Paul. It's called The Borzoi Killings. I recommend it. It's a thriller. And after the break, we'll be back with some thrills of our own. We've got some callers on the line and also a report from New Hampshire.
Radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Happy New Year, America. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for our good friend Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And I'm glad to say that we have ZZ on the line. What's on your mind, ZZ?
Well, see, you got me just bigger than Dallas. I am glad you finally got me on the air.
Well, I've been looking now forward to your call.
Well, your ears would have burned yesterday. They kept me on the line the whole time, and I never did get on.
Well, thank you for calling back today,
anyway,
and we appreciate your patience. Tell us what you're thinking.
Well, you know, the rest of the nation isn't going to get fixed until D.C. gets fixed. And there's one way to fix D.C., and it's relatively simple. You need to take about 200 D9 caterpillars, if you know what those are, and fill those bad boys up with JP1 and put them all about 5 feet behind the district line. That's 10 miles by 10 miles, so about 5 feet. Set the buckets down level, put the downriggers down, put that thing in fast forward, mash the pedal to the floor, and go at it and push that whole son of a gun into the Potomac.
So ZZ's suggestion.
And when you're done with it.
I'm laughing at the image.
And when you're done with it.
Yeah.
And when you're done with it, there is so much compost in that place from 200 years of you-know-what that y'all could plow that up and you could grow zucchini squashes the size of a Greyhound bus.
Thank you, ZZ. I like this idea, bulldozing Washington, D.C. Now, on line 5, I think it is, Don from Montreal. Don?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Thanks for taking my call. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, tell us what you're thinking,
happy
Don.
Happy holidays to you and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
You know, I caught the segment this morning about Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. And first of all, I'm heavily involved politically in my country, Canada, here. So I have an inside view of it. And for him to have an economic plan that will bring in and repatriate like trillions of dollars to spur the economy, that's absolutely phenomenal from my point of view. Whereas our prime minister over here, he's just putting us into about another $100 billion of debt over the next 4 years to spur the economy. It's the wrong approach, totally, in my view. So for him to bring back that trillion or two to get new investments coming in there and to turn the country around, I'm all for it. And he's got my vote if I was down there in the States.
Well, thank you. And, you know, your new prime minister is taking a visit to the United States, and he's going to have dinner with Barack Obama. Maybe he ought to wait and have dinner with President Trump instead.
Well, maybe.
What do you think of that, Don?
And you know, for our prime minister, well, yes, I think so, because our prime minister is wants to pull out from the combined, pushback against ISIL or ISIS, and I think he's just being cowardly on that. I don't know, you know, what's going through his mind to pull out of. You know, and you know, what's the strategy behind that? And even President Obama, when he was mentioning other countries, he kept the name of our new prime minister out of it. And that is a strong message of the displeasure that not only probably the United States, but all other countries in the world going like, what are you doing, Canada? I mean, Russia's knocking. Mr. Putin's knocking on our doorstep from the north because he wants to get the oil from the Arctic. And he may encroach more and more on the Canadian territory. And what's Prime Minister Trudeau going to do? You know, turn around to President Obama and says, please help. You know, when he's not helping out, it's just...
You're right. I'm so glad you called, Don, and my sympathies to Canada for your new pretty boy prime minister. We now have Senator Larry Pressler on the line, an old friend and a great senator from South Dakota. He served 2 terms in the House of Representatives and 3 terms in the U.S. Senate, and now he's doing some things that are so interesting. I asked him to join us today to tell us a little bit more about life after the Senate. And one of the things, Larry, that you're working on, I really want you to describe, the Jericho Project on Homeless Vets.
Yes. Good morning, Betsy, and thank you very much, and Happy New Year to you. And thank you for continuing your tradition of public service. The Jericho Project is a nationwide project for homeless veterans. And there are 2 homes in the Bronx where that I've been to, and one home being built in Harlem. They work on the problems of homeless veterans. And my big contribution has been organizing a fishing trip every year for some of the veterans in different states that people can take veterans who are in these homes out for 1 day fishing. So that's my great innovation, I guess. But I also am working on the centrist project, a project that's trying to encourage more centrist thinking in politics and in the universities and in the press and elsewhere. I'm sort of a practical, old-fashioned senator in that a former senator, in that I believe we have to address the practical problems of day-to-day problems in some of these campaigns, and we get kind of carried away, and I'm very worried about the deficit, the size of the deficit.
Well, so, I am too, especially after this omnibus spending bill. What was the Congress thinking? They pledged to us 2 years ago that they were going to rein in spending, and now they've just busted open the bank again.
Yes, this is one of the most amazing things in American history. That bill passed with almost no objection. For example, Ted Cruz could have filed a cloture petition, and he and his friends could have filibustered for a while, and they could have gotten a cloture vote, and they might have stopped it in the Senate. And this, what I can't understand, is the Republicans running for president, the senators, they did not offer a cloture motion on it. And the Republicans in the House, and these are conservative Republicans, so I'm not just talking about the leadership, They barely raised a procedural objection in the Rules Committee. They could have stopped it in the Rules Committee in the House.
What a shame. What a shame.
But historically, this bill, and by the way, I am personally for tax increases if you spend the money. Barry Goldwater used to say, if you spend the money, you got to have the guts to vote for tax increases and go back to your constituents.
And that would sure put an end to all that reckless spending, wouldn't it?
Well, it would. Now, for example, the highway bill. I'm very much for the highway bill. I've written a new small book called An Independent Mission. I ran for the Senate as an independent. And the independent project is going to be supporting some independent candidates next year in the elections. We're trying to figure out this in large number of people who call themselves independents, but unfortunately most of them don't vote. But on the highway bill that passed, and we need that, it wasn't funded. The gas tax was not increased, and it wasn't funded from it. So they added it on to this is a Republican House. The conservatives in the House came up with this plan to add it to the Federal Reserve debt. That's real smoke and mirrors twice removed.
Right.
I have a great fear that all the debt, and that doesn't even count as part of the national debt. It's debt over here on the side. From the Puerto Rican debt to the debt we have there, and I know I'm just an old, people's eyes gloss over, there's no discussion of a deficit in the current presidential campaign by any candidates on either side.
Which is a terrible omission, because our children and grandchildren are going to have to adjust to a radically lower standard of living to service this debt.
That's right. And the radically low, yeah, you said it so eloquently, Betsy, as you usually do. It will be a radically lowered standard of living. Probably the top 10% will escape that. But it isn't necessarily, it won't come necessarily in the form of inflation. Just our money is worth less. It's a new concept in economics, in the sense that if you go to Europe or someplace and you buy a cup of coffee, it costs you $12. But our whole system is, financial system is just, I believe, on the verge of collapse. But that's a doomsdayers scenario. But I was very upset with that bill that went through the U.S. Congress without being paid for. Now, if they want
unread to... Unread and unpaid for. Let's underscore it. Unread and unpaid for.
Yes, and it came, and it could have been stopped by the conservative Republicans. I would probably be considered more of a moderate Republican if I was, when I was in office. I support certain government programs that I think are necessary, and I'm a practical man. We've got to have education, and we've got to take care of the elderly and so forth. But this bill had all was, and what the Republicans got was certain tax breaks were made permanent or something like that. And it's unbelievable they will say, well, those are just the Republican leaderships. Those are the Mitch McConnells of this world. No, it's every conservative in the United States Senate who didn't offer a cloture petition. And
they rolled over. They rolled over. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes, they may have voted against it, but they didn't. In the House, they could have stopped it in the Rules Committee from coming to the floor without an opportunity for more amendments. In the Senate, they could have offered it. Three senators can get a vote on a cloture petition. That means you have to vote the cloture petition. That would have been a chance to filibuster for 2 or 3 days at least, if they could only get a few people to help. And then they'd get an up or down vote on the cloture. And it may well have, the other side would have had to produce 60 votes. They didn't do that. The Ted Cruz's of this world who else is running for president? Marco Rubio, especially Marco Rubio, should have joined with Ted Cruz and Rand Paul in offering a cloture petition, it's called, which means that you can get a vote on proceeding, but there is no limit on debate on a cloture petition. But
right.
They didn't do that. I mean, these fellows.
They were so afraid of being accused of shutting down the government. Everybody wanted to meet that deadline and go home. But we, the American people, really got bamboozled and shafted on that one.
Well, that's right. And at some point, you have to move towards shutting down the government. Indeed, when George Bush Sr. was president, they had all those meetings out at the Air Force Base. I went to them on the budget. And at that time, the press blamed the president. Well, he's president. He will have to keep the government from shutting down. And he had to agree to a tax increase, which he had pledged in his campaign not to. But
right,
to
it ended his political career, really.
It did, but nevertheless, he had the courage to do something.
Yeah.
That and Bill Clinton balanced the budget. I know nobody likes to hear that, but he did. And that's
Senator Pressler, you are so full of information. Let me just wish you a happy new year. I hope you'll come back
happy
next
new
time
year
I'm
to
hosting.
You.
Thank you for
happy
all
new
these
and thank
insights.
You, Betsy, thank you on your remarkable career, and thank you for getting germs out of hospitals. And thank
you're
you for
welcome.
All the other things you've done and you're continuing to do.
Thank you. We'll talk soon. Happy New Year to Larry Pressler. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingram Show.
And we'll swim in Barton Springs on New Year's Day.
Oh, Happy New Year, America. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. Please call us at 855-40-LAURA. 855-40-LAURA. We love getting your calls. And you can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle and email me at BetsyMcCoy.com. I've assembled a very special program for you today. My gift to you with a wish for a Happy New Year's. And our next guest is the expert on New Hampshire politics. He is co-host of the New Hampshire Perspective. He is director of policy programs at a think tank. His name is Jeff Chittister. Jeff, welcome.
Hey, Betsy, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you. And I'm so excited to have you on the line to give us an up-close look at what's happening in New Hampshire. We've got the moderates, so-called, Christie, Bush, John Kasich, and Marco Rubio vying for the Granite State vote. How is it sorting out?
Well, I mean, sorting out really good, Betsy. I think when a lot of people look at New Hampshire, they try to figure out where New Hampshire fits into the larger scheme of things. And, you know, there's two goals New Hampshire tries to achieve. One is hopefully we're selecting a winner in the primaries on the Democrat and Republican side that go on to become president. But the other thing we do is we whittle down, if the field is really large, we tend to whittle that field down or at least give people a different perspective on candidates they hadn't thought about before. So generally speaking, I mean, I think that we're really starting to get into that position. Up to this point, you know, we've looked at how the campaigns have rolled out, and there still is a lot of decisions that have to be made by the voters. You and I joke all the time. Everybody knows our state motto, live free or die, but we actually have a second state motto. It's called, you're in my top three. And that's what we hear an awful lot coming out of December. And I think next week, as we see more of the candidates come in, and with about 30 days left towards the primary, we start making our decisions.
So one of the things that I'm curious about is New Hampshire is a state that allows independent voters to vote in the primary, yeah. Undeclared voters. Is that going to be a big wild card this year?
I think it is. I think when you look at the influence of someone like Donald Trump, and I remind people that we've been through this before. Back in 1996, Pat Buchanan won our primary. And much of the same reasons why Pat Buchanan did so well in New Hampshire back then are the same reasons we're seeing now, too. There is, and you've seen this, Betsy, as you travel the country, there is this sense that Washington has lost complete touch with us out here in the rural America. And that really has started to frustrate us. And so when we look at how that might play out, what we've seen, especially in this election, is Donald Trump keeps pushing the issues that are extremely important to us out here beyond the dome of Washington, D.C. And I really think that what we're going to see over the next few weeks is either some of those other candidates are going to readapt their message and start getting stronger on those key issues, and then you'll see a few more actually start thinking about how they can portray themselves more of an outside D.C. person.
A closing question for you, Jeff, because you really have the insights here. I hear in your voice a suggestion that Trump may win this New Hampshire primary. Yeah. Most of the pundits outside the state aren't saying that. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Well, I think we've said it before that it looks like with the numbers based on what they are right now, Trump could do very well and win. I always like to remind people, you know, we have over 800,000 voters. Most of those don't make their decision until the Sunday before. I mean, we have a large constituency that participates in the primary. But with the lead that he has, I think that some of the other candidates are going to have to strive very hard to push past that. But I also always like to remind people, too, is that if you look at our history, it's not the first place winner that does very well further on down the primary cycle. It's the second place winner. You've got Barack Obama. You've got certainly when you look at some of the other ones, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, they all placed second in previous primaries and went on to do very well in the general.
That really opens our eyes. Thank you so much, Jeff. And I hope that I see you in New Hampshire soon. I'll probably be coming up early in January. Happy New Year to you and all the Granite Staters.
Happy New Year to you as well. Don't forget, live free or die.
Thank you for joining our New Year's Eve celebration. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. In a moment, we're going to be speaking with a very special guest, Richard Winger. He is the expert in the nation on ballot access and how to run for president on a third-party line. But before we get to him, I've got to take this call on line three from Lori. Lori, tell us what's on your mind.
First of all, Happy New Year. What's on my mind, the last past 8 years, the economy and everything's been going downhill since having President Obama in office. We should have impeached him years ago, and I'm disappointed that Mitt Romney didn't win. And that's what was on my mind.
A lot of people share your feelings, and let me say, there are certainly grounds for impeaching Barack Obama. He has violated the Constitution numerous times. I can't remember another president more culpable of executive overreach. But yet, only a few members of the United States Congress have expressed any interest in curbing his unconstitutional abuse of executive authority. So we're stuck with him a few more months. But thanks for calling, Lori. And just remember, in the new year, we've got a shot at electing a new president. Good news. Happy New Year to you. Thanks so much for calling. And now let me introduce my guest. Listen, I had to really go find this man. He is an authority on election law. His name is Richard Winger. He is the editor of Ballot Access News and also sits on the editorial board of the Election Law Journal. So it all sounds very esoteric, but in fact, he's going to make it simple for us to understand. Thank you, Mr. Winger, for coming on to tell us how it's possible for a candidate to run for president on a third-party line. Is it possible this year?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. And sure it is. It's very possible.
Okay. I was looking at the state-by-state deadlines for getting on the ballot in each state. And is it possible for a candidate to wait until the Republican convention, for example, and then decide?
Somebody who waits that long would probably only be able to be in the ballot in 30 states unless some minor party that's already on the ballot chose to nominate him or her.
I see. Okay, so now we have two candidates we talk about all the time with the possibility of a third-party run. One is Donald Trump, but he's so far ahead, unlikely maybe. And now in the news is Jim Webb, a candidate who's been a Democrat and a Republican at one time or another, and he's talking about a third-party run mostly to spoil Hillary Clinton's chances. And have you sized up Jim Webb's plausibility as a third-party candidate?
I think he's thinking about running, and I think he's very well informed about the deadlines and the petition requirements. I think if he decides to run, he would decide in March, after the whole country gets a little clue as to who the Republicans are going to nominate. So I think he knows what he's doing, and he could get on the ballot in all states.
And he could be a real spoiler against Hillary Clinton, am I correct?
Well, I've seen a lot of discussion about that, and I think most people think that's rather ambiguous. There's reasons to think he could draw equally from both major parties.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, you're the real expert on the history of this. And tell us, for example, how this has played out in the past. Theodore Roosevelt, for example, in 1912. Tell us about that one.
Okay, I'm very glad you asked me about that. It's really interesting because most people don't know how much our rights as voters have been curtailed in the last 100 years. Back in 1912, Theodore Roosevelt thought he would get the Republican nomination in June, which is when the convention was. But he was surprised. He didn't get it. Incumbent President Taft got it instead. So Theodore Roosevelt was perfectly free back then to start a new party after June and still get in the ballot of all but one state. And that was the Progressive Party, nicknamed the Bull Moose Party, because back then the typical state had a deadline in September or October. Now it's much more restrictive.
And why? Because the political professionals want to guard against third-party upstarts. Isn't that what's happened here?
That's certainly true. Over the years, state legislatures have put these deadlines earlier and earlier. And it would be worse, except in 1983, the U.S. Supreme Court said early petition deadlines for independent presidential candidates violate the First Amendment.
Well, so they put a stop to rigging the system anymore. Now, this morning in the Wall Street Journal, there was an absolutely fascinating article on the editorial page about what will happen if no Republican is the clear winner of a sufficient number of delegates to win on the first round at the Republican National Convention. And they mapped out all the different alternatives. And I had a couple of questions for you. How likely do you think it is that the votes will be very dispersed among these candidates as they go into this convention?
Well, it's always dangerous to predict. But right now, it could change easily, but right now I'm starting to think Donald Trump can get over 50% of the delegates. But it's, you know, who am I to say that? Who can predict the future? It's very hard.
Well, you've looked at a lot of elections, not just at the rhetoric. You've looked at the actual history, state by state. So that may happen. But the other thing that could happen that was brought out in this article is that he may fall just slightly short of the majority needed, and he will go to the convention to try to get the extra delegates. But that's where the professional politicians, the insider class, really go to work to prevent that, right?
Well, I tend to see a slight shift. I think the professional class are slightly warming to Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a comment by Ohio Governor John Kasich just yesterday, which seemed to imply that he's getting a little bit accustomed to the idea that it just may be Donald Trump, and maybe that isn't so terrible after all.
Or maybe he just doesn't want to get slapped down by Trump anymore.
Well, that could be.
All right. But let me ask you something. So if we make it to the convention and there's no clear winner, one of the things that was brought up is that the delegates really aren't bound to any candidate after the first round of voting. Right.
That's right. It's only one round. Exactly. Now, so this is why it's so important who the delegates are, what's
yes.
in their heart.
And who chooses those delegates?
It's different in every state. Mm-hmm. In some states, Trump has total freedom to pick any delegates he wants. And he can certainly vet them and figure out, are they really loyal to him? But the rules are awfully complicated, and in some states, he doesn't have that freedom. They can say their pledge to him in the first ballot, but he can't control who they are, and he can't see if they're really, really loyal to him.
And if the state party mechanism is choosing those delegates, it's likely they may be people who are more obliged or beholden to state party executives, to state party regulars, than to any of the candidates. They'll do whatever those bosses tell them to do.
Yes, I agree with that statement. So it's going to be a circus.
Well, that's a good way to end this interview. Mr. Winger, thank you for lending your insights. I hope we can call you again. You really know what you're talking about. And as we get closer to the convention, your expertise will be in demand. Thank you so much. We now have online Terry from online two, Terry from Nebraska.
Good afternoon, or morning, actually, Phil. And Merry Christmas and a belated Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Thank you, Terry.
I told your call screener that it's with the progressives and liberals and Democrats, it's the Constitution is called an inconvenient truth.
Good point.
Because they don't understand it. And the road to hell is paved with good intentions. They have well intentions, but they're sending us to hell.
Well, it is unfortunate. So often now I hear people on the left say, well, I want to do what will benefit the people, as if we have a government of unlimited powers and that good intentions are enough. But as you just pointed out, that road is paved with good intentions, and yet it leads to the total loss of personal freedom when we allow the government to abuse or disregard the United States Constitution. It seems as if we're heading to a new system in our country where we have two major political parties, the Republican Party and the Banana Republic Party.
I come from a long line of hardcore Democrats. But on my birth certificate, it says blood type D, Democrat, caution, live brain. I think. I analyze what's going on, and that's what I speak about.
Well, that's a very good point. I'm glad you raised that point. And Happy New Year to you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Now, we're getting ready for a very big holiday, New Year's Eve. And I wanted to share with you some major facts about this special night, because wherever you are in the world, chances are you may be watching that New Year's Eve ball drop in Times Square. So I dug up some facts for you. Number one, the ball has arrived in New York. It is Waterford Crystal. It has 32,000 lights. It weighs 11,800 pounds. It's 12 feet in diameter. And 1 million people in Times Square are going to be watching that ball as it descends. But here's the really amazing fact. 1 billion people, three times the population of the United States, 1 billion people around the world will be watching that ball drop on television. Can you imagine? That's what a symbol of the new year this has become. 1 billion people will be watching it. This Times Square celebration began over 100 years ago in 1904, and the ball dropped for the first time in 1907. So no matter where you are, if you turn on your television and you watch that ball drop, you'll be participating in what used to be a great American tradition and has now become a great worldwide tradition, the New Year's Eve ball dropping. Back after the break, this is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Thank you, America, for staying with me. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, wrapping up our pre-New Year's Eve celebration. It's been a blast. I'm so glad I could share it with you. And on line one, David from Albany. David, what's on your mind?
Ma'am, it's not going to be the Republican convention that's going to be messed up. It's going to be the Democratic convention. Mrs. Obama is going to be nominated on the floor. Hillary's going to be kicked in the ditch. Her candidate or her support will flock to Michelle Obama so fast, Hillary's pants will fall off. And
I like that image.
And nobody, I don't really particularly like it. Nobody's going to be able to touch her. No Republican is going to be able to touch her. She'll be the first Negro woman, and it'll fulfill everybody's hopes and dreams.
Well, let me ask you this, David. You don't think that Hillary Clinton's going to go into the Democratic National Convention with the majority of the delegates already sewn up? That's what the rules require.
How can anybody support Hillary Clinton with the baggage that she's got?
I totally agree with your sentiment, but it may not happen. Nevertheless, I'd like to wish you a happy new year and thank you for your call. Okay, we only have a little time left, and now I have to speak from the heart because I care so much about this issue. This is the holiday season, and now especially, but all year long, you may be going to the hospital to visit a friend or even face a hospitalization yourself. If you do, please come to our website, hospitalinfection.org. Hospital infection is one of the major killers in the U.S. It kills more people than auto accidents and breast cancer combined. Can you imagine? And it's totally preventable through proper hygiene. If you're going to the hospital to visit a friend or a loved one, forget the candy and the flowers. Bring a canister of bleach wipes and a pair of gloves and wipe all the surfaces around your loved one's bed, the bed rail, the over-the-bed table, the IV pole, that computer keyboard in one corner of the room, every surface. You could be saving your loved one's life. Because the biggest factor causing these hospital infections is inadequate cleaning. The germs are left behind when the previous patient was discharged. In fact, the number one predictor of who gets an infection in the hospital, it's not your age, it's not the sickness that brought you into the hospital, it's what room you're put in. If you're assigned to a room where a previous patient, even 2 or 3 weeks before, had an infection, your risk goes way up of getting it because that other person was discharged, but their germs were left behind, still waiting on that bed rail. So that's what I wish you, a new year full of health for yourself and your family. Freedom, of course, our most blessed gift in this nation. God bless you all. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year from Betsy McCoy.